from NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And today, a special Texas Senate committee is meeting in response to the shooting last month at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, in which 19 children and two teachers were slaughtered. Director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Steve McCraw, testified, laying out the timeline and missteps made along the way. Some of it is crushing. It's the first time he's spoken in public about the shooting since late May, when he criticized Uvalde School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo for not ordering officers into the classrooms where the gunman was holed up. Camille Phillips is a reporter for Texas Public Radio. Hi, Camille.
Hello.
We're going to get to the hearings, but we're also learning more that's tough to hear from the Austin American Statesman newspaper and KVUE-TV. Both reported last night that officers inside the school had bulletproof shields and vests and assault weapons. Tell us more about how they had the tools.
Yes. It's now been confirmed also by the state director, you're talking about Steve McCraw, that they had the tools on hand within 3 minutes to break in and confront the shooter, and that it was just wrong decisions to not, in his words, to not act sooner and against all training that's been, you know, the accepted training for about 2 decades now.
Right, because we've been hearing that they were waiting for officers that had the tools. Officers were there with these shields, bulletproof shields. And is it possible that Arredondo and others spent time looking for a key that wasn't needed?
Yes, that's also what McCraw said today, was that even though Arredondo was looking for keys, a master key, for over an hour, he doesn't believe that that master key was needed. He said that the door, the classroom door, was unsecured. They have video footage of the shooter going in out of the classroom multiple times, and that that door is unable to be locked from the inside. It's supposed to be an automatic thing.
Here's Steve McCraw, again, director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, as he's talking about this. He was asked about it by Texas Senator Robert Nichols, chair of this special public hearing.
So the teacher could not even lock the classroom door from the inside?
That's correct. There's no way to lock the door from the inside, and there's no way for the subject to lock the door from the inside.
It was open.
And so the officers waiting at the door didn't try to open it because they were told it was locked. McGraw also noted that even if it was locked, officers there had breaching equipment.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. They had multiple breaching equipment, at least one called a Harrigan. It's a specific type of tool. But yes, they had the equipment. They had body armor. They had rifles. And even if they didn't, all of the training involved is to go in and confront the shooter.
Yeah. What else came out today, maybe even about the shooter?
Yes, he revealed a lot of, or confirmed a lot of information about the shooter, indeed purchasing guns right away and in communicating on some private messaging platforms, you know, gaming platforms and such, that he was thinking of doing a shooting, that again, that he purchased, that he wanted to purchase a weapon beforehand. A lot of this is signs that officers say, you know, need to be reported more quickly to them so that they can act and prevent more of these shootings.
We're also hearing there were red flags about the shooter, possible animal abuse that should have set off alarms.
Yes, he said that was only through testimony, that they didn't have actual physical evidence of that. But all of these are signs also, you know, domestic violence is, you know, seen as a precursor to shooting as well. But of course, it's easy to say this after the fact once you're doing an investigation, right?
Yeah. Well, last night was the first school board meeting in Uvalde since the shooting. A lot going on. You spoke with parents and family members. Here's Brett Cross, uncle of Uzea Garcia, one of the students killed.
Innocence doesn't hide. Innocence doesn't change its story. But innocence did die on May 24th at Robb Elementary. Not just the victims, but every survivor, every child that heard those shots, every child that ran from the school, every teacher that stood steadfast in front of their children.
Camille, I can't imagine how the parents are feeling hearing some of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's just added insult to injury, to put it lightly. There's, you know, trying to grieve and trying to make sense of something that is just completely senseless. And the information that they're getting from officials just keeps on shifting. And so they can't even get a clear answer of what happened and why and how they can make sure it doesn't happen again. So they're really just wanting accountability, as you can hear. In that board meeting last night, they were asking for real action, for the school board to take action. I do say this is actually the second school board meeting since the shooting.
Well, we will continue to follow this. Texas Public Radio reporter Camille Phillips, thanks for helping us today.
You're welcome.
And as we follow it, we will also be watching for decisions this week from the Supreme Court. Today, it was a win for supporters of religious schools. By the count of 6-3, justices ruled that the state tuition program in Maine must include private religious schools. In a scathing dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that the court continues to dismantle the wall that separates church and state. Emily Bazelon is senior research scholar at Yale Law School and staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Hi, Emily. Always good to speak with you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and tell us about this law in Maine that would pay for non-religious private school tuition in rural communities where people don't have the option to send their kids to public secondary schools.
Yeah, so actually half of the school districts in Maine don't have public high schools that are local. And so Maine has a program that allows families to choose a private school and the state will pay for it. Maine, however, restricted choice to non-sectarian schools. And what the state said was that it didn't want to endorse religion by paying for religious instruction. The Supreme Court today said that that was itself unconstitutional.
Well, in fact, Chief Justice Roberts wrote for the majority that Maine's decision to exclude those religious schools promotes stricter separation of church and state than the federal constitution requires. What else can you tell us about why the court ruled the way it did?
The court is basically saying here that once a state has what the court calls a neutral benefits program in which public funds are flowing, that it can't exclude religious organizations, even if it wants to do so. And so this is resolving a tension between the Establishment Clause, which creates a wall between church and state in the Constitution, and the free exercise of religion that families were claiming. It's resolving that tension entirely in favor of freedom of religion and saying that basically there is no wall between church and state on this issue.
In fact, we quoted Justice Sotomayor, who went on to say that the decision leads the country to a place where separation of church and state becomes a constitutional violation. What points are the dissenting justices making?
Right. So Sotomayor was very strong on that issue. And Justice Breyer asked a couple of important questions, particularly about voucher programs. So given the court's reasoning today, if a state or a locality has a voucher program that pays for a private school but not religious school, does that program now have to include religious schools in voucher funding? And that is going to be a huge next issue, which I expect we'll see a case pretty soon posing that exact question.
Do you think that question will sort of be the impact of today's decision? I mean, trying to figure out what the decision across the, you know, will mean for other places around the country. Is that the crux of it right there?
Well, there are 37 states that bar state taxpayer funding for religious schools. And really, all of those state constitutional provisions are effectively being struck down or called into question by today's ruling. And then the question just becomes, how is that actually going to play out in American life? And this issue of vouchers and voucher programs and, you know, paying for religious schools through those, that would be a very extensive kind of public funding for religious instruction.
I suppose another question might be whether or not funding could flow to religious schools that aren't Christian.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't think the court is saying here that it's just Christian schools that will benefit. It will be a kind of, you know, pluralistic vision of religion in which, you know, Muslim schools, other religion schools would also be able to get funding. The distinction here is between non-religious and religious schools, not a particular kind of religion.
And stepping back for just a moment here, as Justice Sotomayor points out, the court has ruled in favor of Christian religious groups a number of times recently. It allowed the Trump administration to let employers with religious objections deny birth control coverage for workers. It also stopped restrictions on religious services during the pandemic in New York State. What do you think the big picture here is?
This is a very conservative majority on the Supreme Court, and it cares a lot about extending religious rights, basically, and religious freedom. So in the next term, we're going to see a challenge to laws that prevent discrimination against same-sex couples on the basis of religion. And I think we'll see future cases as well where people say, hey, because of my religion, I work in a pharmacy, I don't want to provide the pills that that allow for abortion. All of those kinds of religion-based exceptions to discrimination, to laws that prevent discrimination or provide a kind of public service, I think we're going to see a very receptive conservative Supreme Court to those kinds of challenges.
Emily Bazelon is senior research scholar at Yale Law School and a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thank you so much, as always, Emily, for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's hard to believe, but this wonderful music came about because of some pretty compelling congressional hearings, not the January 6th hearings making headlines or Watergate 50 years ago. Leonard Bernstein wrote Candide, this is the overture, in response to the McCarthy hearings. In the spring of 1954, Senator Joseph McCarthy held congressional hearings aimed at rooting out suspected communists and homosexuals in America. Bernstein was gay, Jewish, and politically active on the left, already blacklisted by the FBI. His musical answer to McCarthyism was this comic opera about how a young man's naive belief in the best of all possible worlds clashes with harsh reality. There's also another good reason to talk about Bernstein. Bradley Cooper will play him in a biopic that comes out next year. Can't wait. Nor can our classical music opinionator, Fran Hoffner. Hi, Fran.
Hi.
And we are listening to Bernstein conduct his own Candide. This is the overture. It's in 1989, a year before he died. Now, remind us, he's a favorite of yours. Why?
Well, I grew up watching the Leonard Bernstein concerts for young people. Those were a huge part of my music education. So he's just a very familiar figure to me. I feel like he's an extended family member that I had. But he's such a colorful and engaging personality, and it comes out so much in his music that I really can't help but enjoy everything of his I've ever heard.
You can't help it. Plus, he loves percussion, and you're a percussionist, so there you have it.
Of course, yeah.
Candide, it was a Broadway flop. But what an overture. Let's just start from the top and listen to a good chunk of it. Excitement. You know, I mean, it just, he pulls you right in. What do you think he's trying to convey there, given again that part of it is his response to the McCarthy hearings?
I think he wanted a really bombastic, exciting, and also kind of economical opening to this. It's a really exciting overture, but it's actually pretty short. Overtures, I think, usually are in the 7 to 9 minute range. This one's just over 4 minutes. So he wants to hook you with like a really exciting bit of music and then be like, all right, let's get started. I don't want to indulge in this too much.
Well, I'm also thinking of puffed up politicians puffing about, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
In their puffing way. Bernstein, again, a target of the hearings, and blacklisted. What did he say about that?
I think he found it all both ridiculous and frustrating. He was quite left-leaning, but he was never, you know, a full-fledged communist, or, you know, so his relatives who are living now say that he never was. So I'm sure he felt as though he was being picked on for what were otherwise reasonable beliefs at the time.
He said in his affidavit, "I am not now or at any time have ever been a member of the Communist Party, but the FBI spied on him for 3 decades. Hard to imagine, because right after Candide comes West Side Story. Okay, Candide, confusing plot based on a play by the 18th century French writer Voltaire. Lillian Hellman, the writer, and someone who did have communist sympathies, at least, helped with the writing of Bernstein's Candide. We heard a little bit about the attraction for him, this idea of a young man, you know, finding out that life isn't all a bowl of cherries, which he probably did find out during those hearings. But what else do you think was the attraction?
You know, I think it probably just comes at the point of life where Bernstein himself is starting to not only reckon with the youth behind him and what's ahead. Candide is very much about the shedding of optimism and learning about how the world works. And I feel like for Bernstein in his late 30s when this was composed, that's sort of where he sat. I don't really think he sees himself in the opera, but I think it reflects the kind of attitude that would have come not only out of these hearings, but in the 1950s, when I think a lot of American society was supposed to believe things had been made great. And he's maybe a little bit more skeptical of that greatness at the time.
I'm reminded that we go on to see Tony die at the end of West Side Story. You know, a tragic ending there, too. Well, let's listen again to the music. There's that sweeping theme that we heard in the introduction.
Oh, I think it's really seductive and sweet. Though it's also got a little undercurrent of darkness. It feels to me like a classic Bernstein romantic interlude. It sounds very proto West Side Story, and I think you can always hear that optimism in his music, even when he was doing something relatively dark.
Yeah, I feel pretty. And the theme changes again for the big wind-up ending. Let's listen. To ask, where are we hearing Bernstein, you know, blacklisted, those horrific McCarthy hearings, real stain on American history? Where are we hearing that?
I think we're hearing that in the repetitive and consistent percussion and rhythm, the driving force ahead of this. Bernstein is a really stubborn guy. He's not going to be made a fool of by anyone. And I think you could feel that undercurrent of pushing ahead in spite of everything in the sort of marching beat of this music.
Yeah. It's almost like we're dancing as fast as we can at one point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big hit from Bernstein's opera, an aria called Glitter and Be Gay, which meant a different thing back then. But here is the original star Broadway legend, Barbara Cook, singing that song. You hear that almost like hysteria.
Yeah, there is a lot of mania to it. I think he's both laughing with and at this character a little bit.
Well, I did say I don't think he meant Glitter and Be Gay the way it's meant today, but you know, maybe he did. Do we know he was married to a woman but was a gay man.
Yeah, his wife Felicia was aware of his affairs that he had with men, and I do believe he and Felicia had a very loving relationship up until her death. I don't know that this aria, is meant to be autobiographical in any sense, but I think even the optimistic attitude presented in the lyrics probably represent how Bernstein felt about carrying on his two lives. It's just something you got to do, and you have to do it enthusiastically.
Well, dancing as fast as you can. So perhaps in Candide, from Bernstein, a reaction to the mania and insanity surrounding the McCarthy hearings. But I want to look ahead real quick with you while we have you, Fran Hoffner. A Bernstein movie coming out with Bradley Cooper. Man, they've got to get that right.
I know. I really can't wait. But I have a lot of faith that Cooper's going to do it justice.
And what music? I mean, what do you want to hear of all the music?
Oh, gosh, that's such a big question. You know, he just did an interview where he talked about including a lot of Mahler. And so I'm really excited to see what Cooper does with Bernstein and his relationship to Mahler, because I don't think of Mahler necessarily as being a composer who gets, you know, seats filled, maybe in film at least. But Bernstein is really responsible for modernizing Mahler and bringing him to a larger American audience. So I get the sense that we're going to get a loud, explosive Mahler section or sections in this film.
Can't wait. And in advance of the movie, let's listen to a little Gustav Mahler, Symphony No. 2, Resurrection, conducted by Leonard Bernstein and the Cleveland Orchestra. Fran Hoffner, here now as classical music opinionator. Fran, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Gas prices in the U.S. are the highest they've been in a decade when you adjust for inflation. President Biden is directing blame toward oil companies for profiting off of fuel scarcity. Biden has asked 7 oil companies to produce more, but refiners say it's just not possible. NPR's Brittany Cronin explains why.
If you filled up at a gas station recently, my condolences, that was probably painful.
Gas prices soaring to the highest average ever recorded,
as gas prices are at an all-time high.
These record high gas prices in this country, according to...
Gas prices hit $5 a gallon nationwide for the first time ever a week ago. A key reason why is that refiners are not making enough gasoline.
There's been a tremendous challenge with refineries being able to meet demand that has resurged as the economy continues to gain momentum post-COVID.
That's Patrick DeHaan from Gas Buddy, a company that tracks fuel prices. You can think of refiners like an easy bake oven. On one side, you input your raw material, crude oil that's been pumped out of the ground. And out the other side comes your finished product, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel. But there is a bottleneck at refineries right now for a few reasons. First off, the oil sector got annihilated early in the pandemic. When demand for gasoline dried up, some refiners cut back. Denton Cinquegrana is with the Oil Price Information Service.
When you're losing money on doing it, what do? You stop making it. And that's when you shut down refineries, which we have seen happen.
The second thing that hurt refiners was actual physical damage. Hurricane Ida took out a refinery in Louisiana. A fire burned down another in Philadelphia. But the third reason is really the most crucial. The country is in the midst of an energy transition, championed by none other than the president himself.
I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel.
The Biden administration has made it clear that fossil fuels, you do not have a place at the table going forward.
So Cinque Grana says some refiners have repurposed their facilities. In fact, they're making renewables like biofuel instead of gasoline. As a result, the U.S. has lost 1 million barrels of refining capacity over the last few years. And Cinque Grana doesn't think the U.S. will ever refine as much oil as it once did.
I think the refining executives say, well, looks like the writing's on the wall.
The irony is that as refiners are shifting away from fossil fuels, they're making a lot of money. President Biden says it's not acceptable for refiners to be profiting so much when Americans are getting squeezed at the pump. He called for the companies to ramp up their refining capacity. But that's unlikely to happen. For one thing, refineries are already running at full capacity. As for the ones idled during the pandemic, that's not a quick fix either. Not only would it take months to bring them back online, it's also a financial investment unlikely to pay off.
You're talking about a lot of money to get these refineries that are idled up and running. And what I'm being told 5 years from now, we hope you don't exist. Why should I help you?
And as for investing in new refineries, that's pretty much a non-starter. Here's Chevron CEO Mike Wirth.
My personal view is there will never be another refinery built in the United States.
The result is an impasse. If President Biden was hoping the country could refine its way out of high gas prices, that's probably not going to happen. Brittany Cronin, NPR News.
The Wimbledon tennis tournament begins next week, and this Sunday, CNN will air a documentary about a legendary player whose impact on the sport can still be felt today. Arthur Ashe was the only black man to win singles titles at Wimbledon, the U.S., and Australian Open tournaments. In the film Citizen Ashe, he reflects on how stoicism helped him cope with racism in the 1960s and 70s.
Some people say that my notion or feelings of self-sufficiency go too far. I think I can almost withstand just about anything.
Arthur Ashe died in 1993. Citizen Ashe explores how he used his fame to promote civil rights and later AIDS awareness. His brother Johnny Ashe spoke with me about the film back in November, and I asked him what Arthur was like as a boy.
He was my big brother. When Daddy wasn't around, he was the enforcer. And I say that with a giggle because of his mild-mannered nature, but he knew what Daddy expected of us, you know, and he, of course, helped me with homework, checking my vernacular and those, that type of thing. You know?
Sounds like a good brother. Now, you said that Arthur was the enforcer when your daddy wasn't around. That's like, right. your dad was a tough, strict guy. You know, your mother died when Arthur was very young.
Daddy had a lot of respect for authority, and he realized us being born in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia, that things would be tough growing up to a certain degree because we were young Negro boys. And he had a set of values and he had a set of disciplines that he instilled in us. And quite frankly, I'm glad he did for both of our sakes, for Arthur's and mine, because those disciplines are where Arthur's lifestyle started. And it did me in good stead because of my career in the Marine Corps.
Well, people who are familiar with your brother's story may not actually know that you may have played a pretty important role advancing his tennis career, because it was you who volunteered to do a second tour of duty in Vietnam. And that meant that Arthur Ashe wouldn't go into combat. Tell me how you made that choice.
Well, the choice was simple. I didn't want that for my brother. He didn't need that. I had known from an early age that Arthur was more than just a tennis player. Tennis was a catalyst for him. You know, I knew that Arthur was going to make his mark in the world one way or the other.
Well, he may have had much more to give than what he could on the tennis court, but he was still a really good athlete. In 1968, he won the U.S. Open, and we have a taste of what that sounded like.
And he's got it.
He is still the only black man who has ever won that tournament. But what was it like to watch it happen as his brother?
Well, when it was over, all I could do is go to my room and, you know, give it a good fist bump and say he did it. And he called me a little later that day, you know, and he said, I said, well, you did it. You're there now. He says, I'm a champion now and people will listen to me. What that told me was tennis was still a vehicle in his life. It wasn't the end all. And that, in my mind, justified everything that I did.
Well, you know, you're right. People did want to hear from him at that point, didn't they? Because shortly after he won, they invited him on to face the nation. Here's some of that.
If you happen to be black in these times, maybe not 30 years ago, but in these times, 1968, it's really a mandate that you do something. You must. And there are other athletes and other black leaders, period, who are using their positions of power and influence to wheel some practical progress. So it's just simply saying to myself, Arthur, you must do something. You just cannot sit by and let the world go by.
So this is another really interesting thing about your brother. In the early days of his career, he chose not to get involved with the civil rights movement. And he wasn't speaking out like a lot of the other professional black athletes were at the time. Tell me about that and why you think he made those choices.
Because he wasn't ready. If you listen to his answers, you would realize that he had taken some time to think about how he fit into the situation at that point in his life. And he, at that point in his life, was ready to become vocal and active. Being Arthur, he had to pick his time. He wasn't going to do it because somebody else said you need to do it. He had to do it his way.
Well, then he did. And he got pretty active in the anti-apartheid movement for South Africa. He called for boycotts. He demanded that the stadium get desegregated before he would play there. I mean, it was pretty controversial. How much of an impact do you think he ended up making?
I think it was, to a large degree, a great impact. He spent more time in the ghettos of South Africa than he did on the tennis court. You know, he allowed and wanted the young South Africans to see what a free black man looked like. He wanted them to see the possibilities. And when you think about it, that's what Arthur has always represented, the possibilities of life.
Johnny, I want to ask you about another important chapter of your brother's story. It was, of course, his battle with AIDS after a blood transfusion in the 1980s. He tried very, very hard to keep it private. What do you remember about the early days after he got sick? I mean, what was his outlook on the diagnosis?
To a degree, it was devastating because he knew his time in life would be cut short. But what that actually did, it caused Arthur to quicken the pace to do the things that he had thought he might want to do. You know, he got involved with the Heart Association and, of course, the Foundation on AIDS. And he got more involved with lecturing kids and other things. But it just accelerated his timeline for life.
What was that like for you? This was your big brother, you know, the guy who you did an extra tour in Vietnam for.
I'm not going to say it devastated me because I always held out hope for them having found a cure. But by the same token, I realized that, you know, I was in a situation where I had to hold on to the possibilities and, you know, help him in any way that I could. And basically that's what I did, you know, because the very, very few people knew. Daddy didn't know.
Why? I mean, why not tell your dad?
Well, Daddy had already had heart problems. And I think Arthur believed that that would just increase the worry and anxiety that he had had all his life.
And there was the stigma of AIDS.
Well, yeah, but the stigma that Arthur was worried about for Jeannie and Cameron,
his wife and daughter.
I don't think it was a matter of stigma as far as Daddy was concerned. Okay. You know, there was no question in our minds or in Arthur's mind whether he was heterosexual or not. And that's where a lot of the stigma came from.
I want to listen to what I think might have been his last public statement. This is from the Connecticut Forum in 1993.
There is still a tremendous amount of work to be done with the public to assure them that ordinary contact with people like myself poses absolutely no danger to them. I can sneeze in their presence. I can cough in their presence. We can drink out of the same glass. We can use the same knife, fork, or spoon. We can kiss, and you're not going to transmit the virus.
It's amazing to listen to that and remember what it was like in the late 1980s and the early 1990s when AIDS was little understood. But what kind of responsibility do you think your brother felt to then become almost an AIDS activist?
Well, I think the answer to that question is the simple fact that if you think about Arthur's life, he became an activist from the time he won his first tennis tournament in Richmond, Virginia, from the time he went to UCLA and won the indoors and won the NCAA. Arthur's life was quiet activism, because what does an activist do? Activists try to influence people, okay, and I hope they do it for the right reasons. But Arthur living the life that he lived was pure activism without him saying a word.
Johnny Ash speaking with me last November. Citizen Ash will air this Sunday on CNN.
The at one time unthinkable is now taking center stage in Republican politics. Former Missouri Governor Eric Reitens is running for the Senate with an ad in which he holds a shotgun and joins a tactical team armed with assault rifles, storming into a house to hunt down rhinos, Republicans in name only.
I'm Eric Reitens, Navy SEAL, and today we're going rhino hunting. The rhino feeds on corruption and is marked by the stripes of cowardice.
Facebook pulled the video. Well, then there was last weekend's Texas State Republican Convention, during which delegates formally declared President Biden's 2020 election win illegitimate and homosexuality, quote, an abnormal lifestyle choice. Republican strategist Matt Makowiak is president of the Potomac Strategy Group. He's our frequent guest. Matt, start with Eric Reitens calling on Republicans with guns to hunt down and bag fellow Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, in politics today, it kind of appears like there's no bottom. We're in a system now where the incentives are on the extremes. You know, there's really no incentive to be in the middle, to be reasonable, to operate in a bipartisan way. He's obviously hoping the ad, you know, goes viral, helps him raise money, gets him attention. But look, there's just no excusing or defending an ad that, even if it is an analogy and not literal, which I think, again, requires maybe the benefit of the doubt. But for an analogous ad like that, it's just dangerous in today's environment to be talking that way. Mm. You know, this is a new low, I think, in our national political discourse. And I certainly hope it doesn't work for Eric Reitens in Missouri.
Well, what happens to someone like you? I mean, you advise Republicans. Mm-hmm. We're hearing an analysis that, in fact, this is working, that he's getting positive response from the base. That's who he's after.
Yeah. And that's the important thing to remember here is that you're talking about a subset of a subset, right? It's not the overall electorate. And of course, Missouri's been trending red. I think whoever the nominee is probably still has a, you know, 8 or 10 point win in Missouri in the Senate race at the end of the year. Yeah, look, I mean, you know, if you only need 25 or 30 or 32% of the primary electorate in a state like Missouri, then appealing to, you know, the most conservative aspects of the base, of the activist right, may be a strategy that gets you the nomination. Mm-hmm. But you know, everyone involved needs to be held accountable for this. And again, we really need, good and decent Republicans to stand up and say, no, this is not appropriate. If you have concerns about moderate Republicans who are blocking reforms, or not fighting the fight, that's a reasonable argument. I have some frustrations with them myself. But the way to attack that is not through an ad like this. It's to compete in primaries, to wage a battle of ideas with the electorate, and to move the electorate in your direction.
Well, and then there's the delegates at the three-day Texas Republican Convention declaring President Biden's election win illegitimate. We understand that at that convention, they watched the film 2,000 Mules at least three times. That's what was on the convention's program. This is the film by the conservative Dinesh D'Souza, who, by the way, in 2014 admitted to taking illegal campaign contributions in other people's names. But that film, his documentary, makes the case that is being completely dissembled in the January 6th committee hearings that the election was stolen. Bill Barr said in the hearings that the film's premise that, you know, people were used as mules to stuff ballot boxes was completely indefensible. But here you have people taking this in again. Has your party lost control of the electorate and lost them to a lie?
We've lost them a little bit because, and a big part of that, the primary reason for that is that Trump continues to harp on this issue. He seems, really almost constitutionally incapable of looking forward and letting this issue pass. I really do sympathize with anger about the way different states conducted their elections under emergency procedures in 2020. That said, it's a bridge too far to call it an illegitimate election or an illegitimate president of the United States. The question of legitimacy is one the courts decide. But yeah, I mean, look, as long as Trump continues to harp on this and to talk about this and to drive this perspective, some percentage of Republican voters and even Republican elected officials are going to continue to parrot his talking points, at least for the time being.
So what do you do, Matt, as a respected Republican strategist, when people are so invested in things that aren't true, and also in maybe seeing some success in that kind of campaigning? What do you tell your clients? What do you do?
When I talk to candidates, I try to make sure they're focused on the future. I try to make sure they're focused on issues voters care about. You know, right now, the economy, there's a lot of concern about the economy and kitchen table issues, inflation, gas prices, the southern border. And so Republicans have the wind at their back. Why they would take strong issues like inflation and gas prices off the front burner and focus on issues like this that get them nothing, that get them absolutely no additional margin in the electorate, makes no strategic sense.
That's Republican strategist Matt Mikowiak. Matt, thank you for checking in with us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. See ya.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.